Welcome to Fertility and Sterility on Air, the podcast where you can stay current on the latest global research in the field of reproductive medicine. This podcast brings you an overview of this month's journal, in-depth discussion with authors, and other special features. FNS on Air is brought to you by the Fertility and Sterility family of journals in conjunction with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of FNS Unplugged. I'm your co-host, Pietro Bordoletto, and today we are a true tripod. We're missing the fourth leg of the chair. Daylon is, I think, enjoying some recreational activity. He's hanging out on the ski slopes, not thinking about FNS science, and we'll be thinking about it on his behalf. I'm joined, as always, by Blake Evans and Molly Cornfield. How you two?
Hey, everyone. How's it going? Good to be here.
Hi, Pietro. How is the State of the Union? I saw my mom sent me an article that you were in from the Boston Globe.
The State of the Union was strong, I think is what they like to say at those speeches. And it's funny that you mentioned that your mom saw it. I told my mom that I was attending the State of the Union and she asked if I was speaking at it. I said, no, I'm not. I'm simply attending. Usually it's just the president.
Yeah, just the president of the United States.
Not that guy. But the State of the Union was a really cool experience. The kind of the backstory was that I gave an interview to the Boston Globe here locally, and the local congresswoman kind of our district here read it, and it resonated with her. She's a Boston IVF patient of ours, had two IVF children with us, and felt really passionately that this is an issue that warrants kind of a high-level federal discussion. And the way these folks raise awareness about issues is that each member of Congress gets a guest that they can bring to the State of the Union. And they spend the whole day kind of walking around, giving interviews with that person and being asked, who's your guest and why are they here? I was the arm candy. I was the guest. And I was there because IVF post-Alabama is kind of like it's a scary time to be in our field. There's so much stuff that's happening that it's crazy that we have to have these conversations and talk about why it's worth protecting. But really what I did throughout the day was remind people that IVF is a winning issue. People are pretty pro family building, regardless of your political affiliation or what zip code you live in. So there tends to be pretty broad support for IVF itself. And I'll tell you, as I went throughout my day giving interviews, meeting other members of Congress, a lot of them shared personal stories that I won't repeat here, but both Republicans, Democrats, you name it, they told me about their kids that were IVF conceived, their grandkids were IVF conceived, their partner who had a vasectomy who needed IVF afterwards. So much of it came to light, and it was heartwarming to know that people care about it and have personal experience with it. But my plea to them was talk about it, put your money where your mouth is and actually support these bills and pass some federal IVF protection in addition to broader reproductive rights access on a federal level so that we don't have to have this discussion about IVF. We don't have to have this discussion about abortion care. So I was really honored to be there. I was not the only person in our field there. There were other OBGYNs there. There were other reproductive endocrinologists there. Folks from the ASRM Center for Policy and Leadership and Resolve were there. This was an issue that I think a lot of people were thinking about and really wanting to spend time and energy talking about. It was really cool.
That's a really cool experience. I'm really glad you got to go and, as you said, be arm candy to someone. I don't often think of you as arm candy, but I guess you were. That was your shining moment. But that's really, really cool opportunity you got to do.
Is this you saying that I have a face for radio?
I don't read too much into it. I don't call you arm candy, Pietro.
Okay, well, here we are.
Thanks for advocating for our patients, Pietro. Arm candy or not.
It was great to be there, and hopefully we don't have to be there again next year. Hopefully this is a settled science and we're done talking about this next year, but fingers crossed, we're all rooting for it. All right, enough about the State of the Union, things you never thought we'd be saying on this podcast. Let's talk about the science. Molly, why don't you lead us off with Consider This Month?
Great. I had a fun article in Consider This and a little bit more lighthearted, hopefully, than what we've been talking about. So the title of this piece is, Can Oral Melatonin Supplementation Increase the Blastocyst Implantation Success in Women Undergoing Fertility Treatment? First author is Vanessa Calvacante Silva, and last author is Monica Anderson, and they're at the Federal University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. So many of us are familiar with melatonin. Lots of us either recommend it to patients or take it as a supplement to help with sleep. It's a hormone that's predominantly produced in the pineal gland, but also in some other locations, including the gut, and circulates throughout the body. There's a significant body of evidence on egg and embryo quality with addition of melatonin at various points in reproduction. So taken orally during stim, added to culture media, added to vitrification media. Most of the data shows benefit, but some of it is more mixed. And melatonin is actually found at pretty high concentrations in the reproductive tract, in the uterus, in the fallopian tube, and in follicular fluid. And this probably sparked a lot of this initial research, this discovery. So what makes this a consider this piece, where we're really proposing a more novel idea and suggesting new approaches to research, is that the authors are recommending that we focus more specifically on melatonin's role in implantation, which is, I think, is a less researched area for melatonin in reproduction. So the authors open by introducing that shift work and evening light exposure related to sleep deprivation and these disruptions to the circadian rhythm can be associated with impaired fertility. And they cite some mouse and rat studies that suggest that sleep deprivation can slow morula arriving to the uterus and also alter progesterone concentrations. In mice, they've also found melatonin receptors on the endometrial lining, and circadian rhythm disruption can lead to reduced expression of these receptors and then also apoptosis of the uterine lining as a result. And they actually found that this was reversible with the supplementation of melatonin. The authors then make the very big jump to talking about people. And we found that, as I mentioned, circadian disruptions can be associated with impaired IVF cycle outcomes. And I think for us, we think about the higher rates of infertility in doctors who do a lot of shift work and night work. So of course, the stress of infertility can really impair sleep. And so these correlative studies can be pretty difficult to tease apart in people. But we do need to make some sort of leap between this really robust evidence in mice and rats to the much trickier, more convoluted study of humans and reproduction. The authors recommend that researchers shift their focus from melatonin's kind of like impact on ART during stimulation, during vitrification, and shift to the embryo transfer and melatonin in that period around implantation and the maintenance of early pregnancy. They also do cite a study on myo-inositol and melatonin that's been taken peri-transfer and that it did improve pregnancy outcomes in humans. I think many of us have a much higher threshold to introduce new medications or new interventions around implantation and early pregnancy than we might during pre-stimulation or stimulation or the preconception period. Just because we're concerned about effects on a developing fetus, we all think melatonin is probably pretty safe, but I think we just really need a high level of evidence to introduce it. So of course, more research is needed, but I do love a consider this piece that puts some new research ideas out there for any fellows looking for a thesis project or people looking to kind of expand the knowledge in this field. So what do you guys think? Where are we at on melatonin? Where should we be focusing our research? Do you think melatonin's kind of done? We've overdone this research here, or are you at the point of like prescribing it to everyone or recommending it to everyone in your practice? Are we skeptics or not?
You know, while you were talking, Molly, I Googled melatonin, which any respectable scientist and consumer of knowledge does.
Right.
And there was this paper that I found that looked at variations of melatonin throughout the menstrual cycle. And in your mind's eye, if you close your eyes and think about what LH does, you know, low, 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 shoots up high, and then low, low, low. Melatonin looks like it does the exact opposite, where it's pretty high in the early follicular phase. It drops very low around the time of the LH surge and then kind of shoots back up again. And it's interesting that there's this like relationship to the menstrual cycle. So like that to me is good biologic evidence that there's probably something going on and its importance in reproduction. But the exactly what it's doing, I as you were talking, I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds like CoQ10. This sounds like DHEA. Yeah. It's like, oh, we think it does this in the ovary, this in the uterus, this, does it really do all of these things? And does it do it in a meaningful way where an oral supplement's going to make a big difference?
Yeah. And what a lot of people don't know about melatonin is that it's an antioxidant. It's actually a pretty potent antioxidant, and its metabolites continue to function as antioxidants as well. And so all of this data, is it that there's these melatonin receptors, or is it just the antioxidant effect? And a lot of the older studies on impact of melatonin during stimulation and vitrification embryo culture, a lot of these were done at 20% oxygen. So there's going to be more reactive oxygen species bouncing around. And most IVF centers in the US were using culture conditions of 5% oxygen. So it may not be as relevant there, but then maybe that opens up a door for research around implantation. Your point about the menstrual cycle, I didn't know, Pietro. Thank you for finding that on Dr. Google. And it makes me concerned about us just saying to a patient, not that we would say this, but the patients that are on continuous melatonin supplementation, is that actually going to disrupt things? Because that's using like a hammer for a single nail, when actually there should be maybe a more nuanced approach to how you're taking melatonin and when you're taking melatonin.
None of what we do is benign. And I feel like part of the conversation I have with patients with regard to supplements is just like, listen, you look on 8 or 9 of them, individually, they're probably not bad, but they all have a small knowable risk and probably a larger unknowable risk. I have no idea what the cumulative effect of these things is. You could really be introducing some real iatrogenic harm here, despite these being natural, over the counter, not independently scary in isolation. So I lump melatonin into that category with me, where it's like, until there's some level one data that it's going to move the needle for patients, I just don't know that I'm ready to bring it into my practice and start actively recommending it.
Yeah, well said. I agree with you all entirely. I think that I'm going to do just what the category of this paper does, and I'm going to consider this. And that's about where I'll leave it. I think there could be something there, and I agree. I think this very seemingly harmless medication, just over-the-counter melatonin, probably wouldn't harm anything, but like you said, I mean, if it's affecting implantation, if you take it all the time, I mean, you're going to be real tired too. No one wants that. Just sleepy patients. But I think there's something there. We'll consider this. That's what the article is doing. And we'll go from there. Hopefully some more comes of this in the future.
Well said. Consider it considered.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let's move away from melatonin and talk about whole genome screening. Talk about a hard pivot there.
Natural segue.
A natural segue, as one does. This is a cool paper. It's entitled "The First Clinical Validation of Whole Genome Screening on Standard Trophectoderm Biopsies of Pre-Implantation Embryos." It's a word to the wise. I tend to really hate claims of primacy. This is the first, or this, to our knowledge, this is the first. And I know lots of reviewers and editors also don't like that language, but I think this one's actually truly the first and is pretty cool and worth pointing out. This is a paper by first author Yun Tao Shia and senior author, and full disclosure, acquaintance, Noor Siddiqui, out of a company named Orchid Health, which is a pre-implantation genetic testing company. So full disclosures there. This is a commercially available test that we have no affiliation and we're not endorsing, but simply talking about published peer-reviewed science. So let's talk about PGTA for a second. The most recent SART numbers suggest that probably 40 to 45% of cycles happening in the United States are including PGTA. I'll tell you, locally in my practice in Boston, that we're right around that number. We're 40 to 45% in a mandated state. Molly, what does it look like in your state? Blake, what does it look like in your state? Is that kind of your case mix?
We're quite a bit lower than that. I mean, keep in mind, we're non-mandated. But we, I would say maybe 20-25% PGT. We don't do a whole lot.
I would say, I don't know the actual numbers. It feels like about 50-50, 75-25. And it really depends on the patient demographics, how we counsel them about PGT.
There's a lot of PGT being done out there no matter where you are. And I think the march towards universal PGTA feels like it's coming, as long as the technology continues to prove its effectiveness and safety and becomes more cost effective. But PGTA in its current form can really only assess the ploidy status of embryos, or screen for specific Mendelian variants, which the parents are known to be carriers for. But there's a host of other stuff that traditional PGT can't do. For example, it can't look for copy number variants of small things like DeGeorge syndrome. It's not routinely screened in PGTA because the deletion sizes falls below the threshold for sensitivity for NGS platforms. can screen for things like uniparental disomy, where members of a chromosome pair are inherited from one parent and the other parent's chromosome pair is missing. Our Prader-Willi, our Angelman syndrome. These, again, are not tested on regular PGT-A because of just low-pass NGS data. And then this paper is really cool in that it talks about this new concept of PGT-A that involves whole genome screening of embryos. So whole genome screening was a concept that was first introduced in 2009, and clinical whole genome screening has been available since about 2014. It's primarily used to identify genetic diseases in unhealthy individuals, people who are presenting with something, traditionally patients with unexplained or complex medical conditions where conventional stuff has failed to make a solid diagnosis. But as the cost of whole genome sequencing has decreased, there's been an increasing amount of interest from the general public on using whole genome data in healthy individuals. And this is really now an application of how do you use whole genome screening on embryos, which again, I hate that we have to say it, but embryos are not people. Life does not begin at 198 degrees Celsius, but this is applying this whole concept of, can we use whole genome data on healthy tissues, say, to be able to understand more about them in the pre-implantation phase. So what the authors present here is a validation study of their whole genome screening assay using 58 donated embryos, as well as 41 cell lines that were commercially available and purchased to just assess the performance of this new assay against the current clinical standard at being able to detect certain variants using whole genome sequencing and to be able to screen for other things like mitochondrial genetic disorders, microduplications, microdeletions, and uniparental disomy. The way that they did this was nifty, probably just mentioning at a high level, is that they used cell lines that were purchased from a third-party company. One of them was this very well-known cell line called NA12878. It's a unique cell line where the cell line has been fully characterized. The whole genome is known. It's a very helpful, useful reference standard. But they also use other cell lines, one from a young six-year-old boy with DeGeorge syndrome that they've transfected into an Epstein-Barr virus, into B lymphocytes, and be able to and created a cell line, all used for clinical validation studies, used for research. And then ultimately, they also use real-world embryos, embryos that have been donated to research by a couple of fertility clinics that they partner with. And those embryos, once they were donated, they were thawed, and they underwent three separate biopsies. They took two biopsies from each embryo, and then the third sample was the rest of the whole embryo. So they sampled trophectoderm and the actual inner cell mass. And they used the whole embryo as the reference compared to each of the biopsies to the corresponding embryo. And then these samples underwent routine next-generation sequencing steps. They did nucleic acid extraction, amplification, library prep. And really where things kind of changed here is that the sequencing runs were performed on a mini-seq platform. And they did the low-pass aneuploidy screening. And then they also did the 30x whole genome sequencing screening, which the company reports provides them about 100 times more information about 99% of the genome rather than kind of isolated areas of the genome that we traditionally use. So there is a lot of details in this paper, but from a very high level, I want to talk about what they were able to show. They showed that they had pretty good sensitivity specificity from the amplified material. And they showed that the sensitivity and specificity of their test was basically equivalent to the assays that are kind of our gold standard, this unamplified genomic DNA that we use for regular PGT-A. And where this is kind of worth talking about is that this technique allowed them to screen embryos before implantation for not only are there normal number of chromosomes there, but then really perform all this other stuff that we can't currently do in our current setup. We can't do uniparental disomy with next generation sequencing. You can't do microduplications, microdeletions. You can't do hereditary cancer panels, mitochondrial DNA. And even for the PGTM cases, you can do PGTM with this platform without having probe setup, without having to collect saliva samples from living relatives, parents, and send them to a testing laboratory. You effectively have the whole genome that's sequenced and can be interrogated for any number of things, both known and unknown, which is, I think, a really powerful step forward from a what can we get from embryos. And this is the validation study to show that when you compare traditional technology to referenced cell lines, Their test appears to perform at a really high level. The question now is, where does this fit into our clinical armamentarium, right? Just because we can do stuff doesn't mean we need to or can. What's the clinical utility of identifying micro duplications and deletions that don't have clinical relevance? Is this more information that patients want to know about? I imagine if you're a tech executive in San Francisco where money is no option and you want to know everything that's knowable and optimize everything, yeah, this may be interesting, but do you think your patient, Blake, or your patient, Molly, wants to have this degree of control and insight into the embryo before it's used?
Yeah, that's, as you were describing this, I was thinking a few things. For one, pretty cool. Like, that's really impressive that they did this, and kudos to the authors. But then I was also thinking about, how the heck would I incorporate this into my counseling for a patient? I mean, this would just be so complex, and I don't even know if I can tell the patient, is this something you should do? But also, is this something that would replace preconception genetic testing of the parents? Probably not. You know, we still have patients do genetic testing or do evaluations once they're pregnant, even if they've had a PGT embryo transferred. But I guess I had more questions than answers, but I think it's extremely impressive that this is even something that the authors are able to do. And that's really all I have to say about it. I don't know where we fit it in. And is this something that will become routine in the future? Hard to say. Maybe it will be.
Something I like about it is it's not technically truly whole genome sequencing in the way that I understand it. It's actually more of like a very broad, very deep panel, really extensive panel testing. And so the advantage of that is you're not going to get like variants of unknown significance and not know what to do with that. But I think, you know, still expensive, a lot less expensive than I thought it would be, though, looking at the price that they quote. And I think if the cost comes down a little bit more, it could be for utility for patients who, okay, you both had good carrier screening and you're doing PGTA, so we're picking up any, you know, is the book missing from the library? But we don't usually know, is the word missing from the book? That's the level that we're not getting. And especially in states with really significant abortion restrictions for a family that if there was a de novo mutation for one of these severe conditions, they would choose to have an abortion. This would be a desirable thing to have, this kind of panel screening, whole genome sequencing, whatever we call it, of the embryos for these smaller mutations.
I intellectually really like the idea of moving science further. I think when our field expands from new knowledge that we're creating new tech, that it generally is a good thing. But I think the kind of the next crucial step is, when and where does this fit in? And how do we make sure we do it in a ethical way, and ultimately in a way that benefits patients? There are other technologies that I think are nouveau that people have struggles with, right? Polygenic risk scoring is another one that is PGT adjacent, that we spent a lot of time talking about. I'll tell you, our center does offer PGTP through genomic predictions. I haven't really had any patients want to do it. Even patients who come in curious about it, the minute you kind of start talking about what kind of information you get, what does it mean for you when you're having to decide between one embryo or the other? I think fundamentally people want to have a baby. I don't know that there are a lot of people out there that want to have this optimized, risk-reduced, perfect baby. I think it's, yeah, I'll leave it at that. I think we have to start with, do patients want this? Right. And if so, how can we get it to them in a way that makes sense based on solid data?
Right. And then just having so much more information than we'd had previously. And then if a patient has one embryo or two embryos, and there's some random mutation that was identified that's probably not something significant, but now they're like, do I even transfer this embryo? Something that they would not have thought of previously, that creates a whole nother conundrum as well.
And we already struggle with sex selection, right? Like patients who have a male embryo but want a female transferred, discarding that perfectly normal, useful embryo to cycle again to create more embryos. You know, it's, we already kind of face some of those sticky situations.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, kudos to a company doing good work and publishing their science. I think that's always a way to win over hearts and minds when I'm talking to some of these startups, is don't sell us on your pitch deck, sell us with your literature that's published. And we're thankful that they published fertility and sterility reports. All right, Blake, eventually we have to review stuff. Tell us what we got to review this month.
All right. Well, I'm going to first just apologize because it is spring in Oklahoma. Everything is blooming and the wind is very much so sweeping down the plain. So I'm going to apologize if I have any throat clearing or sniffling, but my allergies have been annihilating me recently. So I'm just going to throw that.
You're just being moved by the science.
I did get a little teary eyed when you were talking. So, but it's also my allergies. So what I'm going to talk about, the title of this paper is Bioengineering, a Promising Approach for Standardization and Automation of Assisted Reproductive Technology by Fatma Amjad et al. Out of Iran. So I'm going to first go over background. As always with these review papers, a lot of stuff to unpack here. You don't have to convince us that we know ART is a remarkable treatment for patients who struggle with infertility. However, the authors do call upon a need for optimization of ART success rates. They discuss there's a lack of standardization and automation, which they believe could make IVF more efficient. One promising strategy to improve ART outcomes per the authors is to standardize and automate all steps involved, ranging from high quality gamete selection to IVF, embryo culture, embryo examination, and selection, as well as gamete and embryo cryopreservation. Cutting edge technologies such as microfluidics, as well as artificial intelligence, particularly machine learning, is what the authors mainly refer to in this article, have been developed for this purpose and have demonstrated remarkable potential in this area. So this article provides a very comprehensive overview of how microfluidics as well as AI are being applied in ART to advance the field. So it's always a challenge for me to condense a review article into a succinct review here or summarization, but I'm going to try and do so and make it very summarized. And as I always say, I encourage you to go back and look at the article for a lot of the further in between details. So they first discuss microfluidics and ART standardization and automation. So there's an example that the authors discussed that's really interesting. There's a microfluidic chip, previous work that was cited, where they have a device that literally integrates almost every step of IVF in a chip. It's pretty interesting. So they have a chip in which they have oocytes position, they have sperm screening, fertilization occurs in this chip, they have medium replacement that occurs in there, and then embryo culture. And this can potentially cut down on a lot of work our embryologists need to do, but also it brings up a lot of questions as well, such as, will it even work? And is it reproducible? And is this something that can actually reduce cost by making this soundingly very expensive device? So they first talk about the fertilization process. They discuss that in this chip, this enhances the sperm and oocyte interaction. So it directs the sperm towards the oocyte. It has almost like a fluid direction in the chip. And this also, they claim, reduces the incidence of polyspermy that can be experienced with conventional insemination. So a critique that I have of this is, well, it can't be used when planning ICSI, of course. And we all know that ICSI is admittedly overutilized in non-male factor infertility. But a lot of us use ICSI. Some clinics only do ICSI. So the authors say to address the ICSI issue, there and a patient who has, for example, low concentration, they have this very interestingly sounding mechanism where they have a dielectrophoresis integrated platform, and that guides sperm towards the oocyte chamber. I see both of you have pretty hilarious reactions on your face, but it sounds very interesting. But you know, of course, brings a lot of questions to mind. Well, how is this going to circumvent ICSI? How is this going to circumvent fertilization failure? But the authors discuss that this is definitely something to be considered. So it should go without being said that these approaches definitely need further refinement. They need validation. And is it reproducible? Then they talk about embryo culture process. And if you didn't think things already got interesting, things get a little bit more interesting here. So to mimic the peristaltic muscle contractions of the fallopian tubes, Kim et al. And Huang et al. Discussed their development of a device in which they have partially restricted channels, as well as a digital system that uses what's called electrowetting on a dielectric system to provide a dynamic environment. Yes, electrowetting. So evidently their findings revealed that the rate of embryo cleavage and blastulation compared to a static droplet culture in IVF is significantly improved. And that's a whole nother topic. We could really pick apart that statement in that article in and of itself. But again, I'm just kind of providing the summary of what the authors have in this paper. And so what was particularly fascinating to me is there is another citation by Hio et al., and they developed a computerized microfluidic device designed for its convenient, non-invasive, automatic, and a real-time assessment of embryo metabolism. We all know embryos utilize oxygen, glucose, pyruvate, lactate when developing, when you look at cleavage stage versus blast stage. And it literally is monitoring that. And this device actually will adjust enzymatic levels for the developing embryo. And it mixes these substrates for the embryo as it develops. Pretty impressive, right? However, contrary to the intention of creating said devices to help make things easier, the authors discuss that these approaches are currently very labor intensive, and they need to be more user friendly before streamlined. And they also lack standardization. That should come as no surprise as well. Briefly, and lastly, I'm going to touch on AI, how they talk about how this can help and with ART standardization and automation. And some of these things we actually already do, but for male infertility, a lot of labs already use AI, or they have a machine in which you don't have the andrologist with a little clicker device and looking at the high power field on the microscope and calculating the semen analysis parameters. But they discuss this. They also discuss certain techniques show improved accuracy in predicting success rates of testicular sperm extraction in patients with non-obstructive azoospermia. Before I move on, do you all use any AI machines in your labs, time-lapse, the semen analysis machine I discussed? Do you guys utilize those?
We don't, that I'm aware of. It's all the andrologists with the clicker.
Pietro, yeah. What about you all?
At Cornell, where I did fellowship, we were pretty all in on time-lapse imaging and the use of artificial intelligence for embryo selection, not currently where I work.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I know that's pretty mixed across the country. There's, you know, some people really feel passionate about time-lapse and you know, some people very strongly feel that the data is just not quite there. But that segues into the next topic of female infertility. So machine learning can be used to diagnose infertility, which is kind of what we do as physicians, but they have a computerized software that can do this based off the patient's history, their surgical history, their medications, menstrual cycle history, provide a personalized dosing for gonadotropins. I know we talked, I believe, on the other podcast about previously for utilizing AI for dosing for IVF. And then they discussed that machine learning and AI can contribute to IVF in mainly three ways, which we kind of already do when we utilize a SART calculator. So one is predict the chance of success for IVF treatment and whether it should be continued. Next is estimate the number of IVF cycles required for a successful pregnancy. And then three, predicting embryo scores and the likelihood of implantation after a blast transfer. And then they touch on time-lapse imaging as well. So these things, of course, like I said, we discuss all these parameters or these things with patients. We have SART calculators, but this is really looking at hundreds of thousands of data points and images of embryos and utilizing that for artificial intelligence and giving you more of an assessment on the patient or which embryo to utilize, for example. So in conclusion, the authors discuss that microfluidics aim to fully automate and miniaturize all steps of IVF into a highly efficient and integrated device. Again, I have a lot of questions and skepticism about this than I do answers, but it's also interesting too. AI is a powerful technology. It enables rapid and intelligent analysis of large biomedical data sets, allowing both physicians and embryologists to make very informed decisions about ART procedures by detecting meaningful patterns and predicting outcomes. Standardization and automation of ART procedures can reduce costs significantly. And this, again, is per the authors. I would push back that we don't know this yet. We don't know that this reduces costs significantly. We don't know that it's going to streamline these processes, but these are all hypotheticals. And it also can potentially minimize errors, contaminations, and enhance reproducibility. And this is, again, once we get there. So all of these things that we've discussed sound really cool in a sense, very futuristic. Maybe one day we'll look back on this podcast and have a good laugh at how naive that we sound. However, of course, at this point in time, there's a lot more work that needs to be taken on is to validate all of these methods before we standardize them across clinics in the country. So what do you guys, I know you have thoughts about this. I see a lot of eyebrows being raised and chuckling with your microphones muted. So what are your thoughts?
So I feel like I can get on board with the clinical pieces of it, the things that could help guide patient counseling. I already used the IVF calculator. Something's always missing in that. You know, sometimes I do the calculator, I'm like, oh, I feel like it's a little higher. I feel like it's a little bit lower for you. And so they're not perfect, but we can always strive for perfection. I just honestly don't totally understand the microfluidics piece that well. I think I would benefit from like a YouTube session, watching some videos on that. But I bet in 20 years, I'll just be sitting in my office, like managing all my microfluidics chambers or something. So as you said, it's good to be introduced to what the future might look like.
Microfluidics fundamentally is just fluid moving through really small channels. And the hard part here was how do you print stuff at such a small scale? And the technology caught up and people were able to do that. Once they figured out how to print stuff at really small scale, then the applications kind of became bottomless, right? And probably the most common application of microfluidics in the ART lab is microfluidic sperm selection, Zyma, for example. That's effectively where sperm are exposed to a small channel and there's fluid culture media that allows sperm to find their way through an obstacle course. But there are a host of companies that are working on, and they're pretty near the translational part where you're going to start to see it in clinical practice, like the IVF lab in a box concept that relies entirely on microfluidics to get eggs dropped off in one spot, get eggs denuded by going through a chamber and rolling them around and getting those cumulus cells off, and then getting cells in position with the polar bodies positioned perfectly for ICSI injection, and then having single step media culture these embryos, and then eventually expose them to cryoprotectant. All of this can be done imagining the concept like a lazy river, right? You start at one end and you end up on the other side in a very different state. In Blake's state, it would probably be pretty sunburned. But for the average person,
very much so.
More than different. But I'm pretty bullish on automation, microfluidics, and tissue engineering in the ART lab. I think for a field that's only 40-something years old, right? We're so early, right, compared to oncology, cardiology, plastics, you name it. They've been around for such a long time. And I'm all for innovation's sake in our field at this stage. But really with the goal in mind that this actually moves the needle and makes things better for practices, for labs, for patients, and is done in a really thoughtful way. So it's cool to see this stuff laid out like this in the review article, just so people have a sense for what's coming, what's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it makes complete sense to, you want to minimize the amount of manipulation that you're doing to these eggs and embryos. And it would be nice to just put it in one little chip and just walk away. And then you have these perfect embryos that you use eventually. But as you mentioned, our field is so young, we've gotten to where we are now. And so things to change that drastically, we're going to have a lot of data before we move forward. But Molly, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
Just that the lazy river analogy really put it together for me. Thank you. Maybe you could make the YouTube video PHO for people on this.
Yeah, where I shine is analogies that a five-year-old can understand. And my five-year-old loves the lazy river. So I thought that'd be a good one for Blake.
Oh, I thought you were going to say for your child, but
No.
Now I see where this is going and I'm kind of hurt. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I guess it's an unintended consequence of the podcast. Well, Dalon, I hope you've enjoyed your afternoon of skiing. I know us and the listeners have all missed hearing about the great science coming out in FNS Science this month. But rest assured, he'll be back with us next month. And we'll be talking about the family of journals and the great science coming out from all of them. Until next time, goodbye.
This concludes our episode of Fertility and Sterility on Air, brought to you by Fertility and Sterility in conjunction with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. This podcast is produced by Dr. Molly Cornfield and Dr. Adriana Wong. This podcast was developed by Fertility and Sterility and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine as an educational resource and service to its members and other practicing clinicians. While the podcast reflects the views of the authors and the hosts, it is not intended to be the only approved standard of practice or to direct an exclusive course of treatment. The opinions expressed are those of the discussants and do not reflect Fertility and Sterility or the American Society for Reproductive Medicine.